So many thanks. At the beginning, I want to talk for the invitation to Erlangen and the possibility to collaborate and participate at the project concerning prognostication. It fits perfectly to the Sonderforschungsbereich Cultures of Decision Making at the University of Münster that started last year. The Byzantine part of the undertaking deals with the supernatural, supporting or influencing processes of imperial decision making. Resources of prognostication and techniques of fortune telling play an important role in that project, but the various practices and written manuals cannot be investigated in detail. My paper tonight will be divided into two parts. In the first section, I will discuss the history of future and the eschatological tradition in Byzantium in a holistic manner. And in the second, longer part, I will focus on practices of prognostication. I will try to present striking examples, and I will add pictorial evidence. At the beginning, I want to give you an idea about Byzantium, because Byzantium may be not known to all of you in the auditorium. If we speak about Byzantium or the Byzantine Empire, we normally mean the eastern part of the Mediterranean, with one center, Constantinople, with the imperial court, the see of the patriarch, and here is the center of political culture in Byzantium. And this area was the core area of the Byzantine Empire until the end in the 15th century. Prognostication formed an integral part of Byzantine political culture and of daily life. Signs, symbola or simia, were recorded in all kinds of written sources. They were explained and connected to cycles of daily life. Nikephoros Gregoras, historian of the 14th century, still connected political developments in the Byzantine Empire with signs that became visible in the firmament. A solar eclipse indicated, for instance, the death of the emperor Andronikos III, II in 1341. Gregoras accepted astrology as a tool for prognosis because it follows mathematical calculations and matches human logical thinking and behavior. Before I'm going to present more details, I will give a brief overview on research concerning the field of prognostication. Various aspects of prognosis have been investigated in the last three decades. Gerhard Bozkalski's Byzantinische Reichseschatologie still is the first reference to the impact of eschatological notions in Byzantine political culture. In 1985, Paul Alexander published his groundbreaking study on apocalypses in Byzantium. However, the practical aspect of prognostication, like techniques or persons or experts, still lacks a thorough investigation. Some studies have been undertaken by the late David Pingree, for example, on the horoscope of Constantinople and the transgression of natural sciences between Arab world and the Byzantine Empire. The most prolific researcher in Byzantine futurology is Paul Magdaleno during the last decades. In 1993, he published an article on the history of the future and its uses, prophecy, policy, and propaganda. He started with discussing the term divine providence that is responsible for the salvation of mankind. The chosen people will be chastised for their sins and rewarded for their faith. From heaven, saviors will be sent in the image of Christ. They will be enlightened progressively by the Holy Spirit, and their way will be prepared for the second coming of Christ. 10 years later, a conference was held at Dumbarton Oaks on occult sciences. The conference volume was published in 2006, and it is still a milestone. Relatively little attention has been paid to that kind of sources afterwards. Included in this volume is a paper of Charles Burnett, who will come to this meeting tomorrow. I think, and he dealt with Latin translation of Greek astrological and magical texts in that volume. The figure of the fortune teller in late antiquity has been investigated by Marie-Thérèse Bögen, professor of the history of Roman law. Her book, Die Enteignung der Wahrsager, Studien zum kaiserlichen Wissensmonopol, combines historical and juridical approaches. A recent publication deals with the magos, or magician, or better expert in occult sciences, Stéphanie Flavianos, La figure du mage à Byzance de Jean Damascène à Michel Psellos, in 2013, published in Paris. And she also provides a prosopography of important figures of that centuries. After this brief discussion of the most important publications, I will start with my first chapter, The History of Future in Byzantium. The Old Testament gives many examples of prophets and prophecies. It was common to include the advice of spiritual man in order to make right decisions. Watching and analyzing the stars and their circulations also left traces in the Holy Scriptures. Eschatology, or eschatological works, played an important role in Byzantine imperial ideology. A lasting effect had the narrations of the alternating kingdoms and the apocalyptic tradition attendant on the New Testament. The Old Testament prophecy, especially the Book of Daniel, where the four world kingdoms are mentioned, are a core text for Byzantine political culture. In Daniel 2 and 7, the dream of Nebuchadnezzar is recorded. He saw an enormous statue made of four materials: gold, silver, iron, and clay. A stone that was not cut by human hands destroyed the statue. That vision had been interpreted by experts in the Old Testament. Astrologers, fortune tellers, Chaldeans, or magicians are mentioned. In his commentary, Jerome, flourished in the beginning of the 5th century, interpreted the four parts of the statue as four empires succeeding each other: Babylonian, Medo-Persian Empire, Empire of Alexander, and the Roman Empire. That concept played an important role in late medieval political philosophy and culture, up to, or even in Russia, this notion or this concept was discussed and recorded in the 15th and 16th century. The second important scripture is the New Testament. New Testament prophecies of the Gospels and Epistles, especially Christ's second coming in Matthew 24:30, is an important passage. And I have the quotation here. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. End of quotation. So this is one of the most important sayings that was quoted and used, and also a little bit changed, and played an important role in political astrology in Byzantium. And another notion that has to be mentioned here is that the world will end corresponding to the 6 days of creation. You know the passage, one day is 1,000 years, and the apocalypse of John has not been accepted in the Christian East, but provided notions of end time as well. And last not least, an apocryphical tradition is apparent that combines Judeo-Christian, Sibylline, and pagan elements. The second coming of Christ steadily provoked discussions. Hippolytus of Rome, for instance, living at the end of the second century, predicted the second coming in the year 6000 after the creation of the world. Such calculations supported the apocalyptic significance of certain phenomena. around the year 500 after Christ, discussion about the second coming grew. Since the beginning of the world was calculated in 5508 before Christ, the reign of the Emperor Anastasius from 491 to 518 matched that date perfectly. Some speculation arose in that period, since the emperor possessed two differently colored pupils, that in conformity was interpreted as a bad sign, so had two different colors in his eyes. In the following decades, especially during the reign of Emperor Justinian, notions of end time circulated. It seems that such prophecies influenced the formation of opinion. But such views and interpretations were criticized as well. A prominent figure of learned circles in the 6th century is Simplicius, a pagan philosopher. He was interested in Aristotelian works and commented on them. In his annotations of Aristotle's De Zelo, he turned out skeptic about those calculations. He writes, quote, "Since according to them, these were the last days, and the end of the world is awaited as never before, surely by now something strange ought to have appeared in the heaven and its movements. If the heaven came into existence just over 6,000 years ago, as he believes, and are now in their last days, as it also pleases him to opine, how come no sign of decline and corruption has manifested itself?" End of quote. Reading contemporary sources, pessimistic views and a perturbed atmosphere become apparent. And this brings me to my first example, how Byzantines dealt with certain omina. In order to illustrate such fears, I want to present an example combining various aspects already mentioned. It illustrates the complexity of both historiographical discourse and interpretation of signs. During the reign of Justinian in the 6th century, many incidents happened that could be connected with apocalyptic notions: famines, plagues, earthquakes, beasts, and so forth. The historiography of Procopius forms one of the main sources of the Eastern Roman Empire in the 6th century. In the 6th book of his Bella, Procopius writes about a sea monster. Quote, "It was at that time also that the whale, which the Byzantines called Porphyrius, was caught. This whale had been annoying Byzantium and the towns about it for 50 years, not continuously, however, but disappearing sometimes for a rather long interval." And then there follows a long description about his deeds and what the population of Constantinople did with the whale. They used his flesh and its flesh and preserved its flesh and consumed its flesh. But then, at the end of this passage, Procopius writes, "Now the Byzantines, observing the earthquakes and learning the circumstances of the Nile's rise and the capture of this whale, began straightway to prophesy that such and such things would take place, according to the taste of each. For men are wont, when present events baffle them, to utter awesome prophecies of the future, and, distracted by occurrences which trouble them, to infer, with no good reason, what the future will bring forth. But as for me, Procopius, I shall leave to others prophecies and explanations of marvels. Still, I know well that the lingering of the Nile on the fields did prove a cause of great calamities, at that time at any rate, while the disappearance of the whale, on the other hand, unquestionably provided an escape from many troubles. However, some say that it was not the same whale that I mentioned, but another one that was captured. End of quote. A fleeting reader may get the impression that Procopius is skeptical about the interpretations of the Constantinopolitan population. It combines the death of the whale with earthquakes and the flooding of the Nile. Procopius does not specify the prophecies, but he passes the interpretation to other persons. Taking the many catastrophes mentioned in the Anecdota, the famous anti-imperial treatise of Procopius, into consideration, the negative, demonic nature of Justinian becomes apparent. However, the veil is not described in great detail in the Anecdota. It is only mentioned in the episode of Empress Theodora when she went by ship to the palace. Reading the works of Procopius, it becomes evident that the author is highly interested in all kinds of prophecies and signs. He recalls his lecture and interpretation of the Sibylline oracles. A passage in the collection may add to the interpretation of the Sibylline oracles. A purple dragon is registered that appears during the reign of Emperor Marco Aurelius around the year 175 after Christ. The stomach of the dragon is full of epidemics and wars. That motif was known to Procopius, and he possibly remodeled it in his Anecdota. In a dream of an aristocrat, the Emperor Justinian appeared as a voracious person who drank off the whole sea twice and disgorged it again. The passage in the Sibylline oracles can be connected to the sea monster that is described in several books of the Bible and in commentaries as well. The apocalyptic negative connotation of monsters or whales was a commonplace in late antiquity. And I take here just one quotation from the most famous example or passage. It is taken from the Apocalypse, chapter 17. Just want to quote it. "And he took me away in the spirit into the desert, and I saw a woman sitting upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was clothed round about with purple and scarlet, and gilded with gold, and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of the abomination and filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of the fornications and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And then when I had seen her, I wondered with great admiration." End of quote. So it is quite evident that Babylon is Rome, and Rome is Constantinople. So this is how contemporary reader would understand that passage, that Constantinople is meant here in this context. The contemporary reader may decipher further illusions and allusions. Since Theodora, the wife of Justinian, was a prostitute in her former life, the interpretation of the veil as a whore is most likely. That denotation was quite common in late antiquity and in late antique Christian imagination. The veil that was called Porphyrios can be seen as a symbol for Theodora. Even the dating of that passage supports it in its interpretation. The sea monster died in the year 547-48, and the empress died in 548. Maybe the death of the veil was seen as a prophecy for Theodora's impending disease. Another detail provides a link to the millenarian interpretations of that period. Procopius mentions at the beginning of the passage that the veil was about 50 years old. If we deduct 50 from 547-48, its birth date can be assumed around 497. That matches almost exactly the beginning of the new millennium. Procopius carefully hides his Kaiserkritik. The dying veil forms a positive sign after the death of Theodora in a number of catastrophes and that emerged during the fourth decade of the 6th century. The example shows both the density of Byzantine texts and the need of multi-layer interpretations, as Juan Sinias did in an article 10 years ago. The term Kaiserkritik can be connected to prophecies and fortune-telling. I mentioned the publication of Marie-Thérèse Bögen, who described the process of monopolization of knowledge, concentrating on occult sciences in late antiquity. One reason of that process was to control opinions. Prophets and fortune tellers were present at the imperial court, and they often belonged to the inner circle of advisors. The prognostications could mislead opinions and influence imperial decisions and behavior. Before focusing on experts as human resources for prognostication, I will introduce a colorful Byzantine source of prognostication that had a great future in the late medieval period. From the Byzantine millennium, works on astrology, books on earthquakes, dream books, and collections of oracles are preserved, and some of them already edited and even translated. A complex example, including difficulties of its transmission and dissemination, is the so-called collection Oracula Leonis. It is named after a Byzantine emperor, Leo VI, who reigned from 886 to 912, so around 900, and he is one of the only emperors who got the Epitheton Sophos, so he was a wise emperor, because he was a very learned emperor. He composed homilies and he also dealt with occult sciences, or the generations after him brought him into that connection. The oracles of the very wise Emperor Leo are not preserved in manuscripts earlier than the 14th century. However, some indicators or quotations show that the text circulated in the Middle Byzantine period, that is before the Fourth Crusade and the capture of Constantinople in 1204. The most prolific author who cites the collection of oracles is Nikitas Koniates, who died around 1217. There's some evidence that the text already was shelved in the imperial library of the 10th century. A Byzantine manuscript was the prototype of a Latin translation in the 13th century, known as Papal Oracles or Vaticinia de Summis Pontificibus. However, the collection was not received by a wider audience before the fall of Constantinople in the year 1453. 15 oracles were compiled by an unknown redactor, most probably in Constantinople. Some oracles were inserted later. Three sections can be determined. Oracles 1 to 6 reflect circumstances after 815, so it's in the middle of the so-called iconoclasm. Oracles 7 to 10 deal with occurrences around the year 1204, the capture of Constantinople during the Fourth Crusade. And oracles 11 to 15 cannot be dated. Numbers 1 to 10 form Vaticinia ex eventu. The rest can be described as real prophecy. The Oracula Leonis do not belong to the Byzantine Apocalypse in a strict sense, although they contain elements from Pseudo-Methodios or visions of Daniel. The prophetic elements focus on the emperor, who is presented as the liberator of the end time. In the 14th century, a new element was added. The emperor sleeps in a rock or a mountain from where he steps out and brings the Ottoman Empire to an end. And this is the myth of the enmarbled emperor, who is sleeping in a marble shrine and will appear when his time has been come. Two versions of Leonine oracles circulated, 16 iambic poems. Each poem was combined with an image. And this is the important thing, that we have two or three excellent manuscripts from the 16th century with rich illustrations. And if you read the inscriptions carefully, you will see that these Byzantine prophecies are connected to Ottoman sultans. Here's, for instance, Suleiman or Bayezid and Selim. So these prophecies played an important role in European courts, because they were used to deal with the Ottoman Empire, and the prophecies were adapted to Ottoman rulers in that period. This is one example from Venice. Another example is, there's a second example in Venice. One is in Amsterdam, and it reflects the need of such prophecies in a time of change in the 16th century especially. The significance of these oracles lies in the afterlife, after the fall of Constantinople. The prophecy of an emperor who will defeat the Ottoman Empire was appreciated by all Christian rulers. That explains some excellently illustrated copies from the 16th century, as mentioned before. The problem is that no modern edition is available, since 40 manuscripts reflect a rather difficult textual history. And I want to give you just two glimpses how these oracles are represented in Byzantine historiography. There are two passages, or three passages, in Nikitos Choniatis, in his Chroniki Diegesis, his historiography, where he clearly refers to that oracula Leonis. I just want to read it to you, this passage. He deals with the reign of Andronikos at the end of the 12th century, and quote, "At sunset, after drinking the cathartic, slowly he evacuated whatever waste matter there was in his excretory organs, and to those companions who asserted that most thought that what the oracle declared of old, 'O scythe-bearer, you have 4 months left,' was said of him, he smiled and said that this was clearly false." And if we go back to the image, this is the illustration of the emperor, and there's a clear reference in the text of Nikitos to that oracle. And shortly after the death of Andronikos, there's a prophecy attached to the new emperor, Isakios, Angelos. I'll go to the next image. And here Nikitos clearly refers to the oracles again. "Whence you came, proving to me what a friend you are. Being yourself temperate, you teach your dearest friends self-control, earning alone the glory that emanates from the palace, by taking the sovereignty from the dying man, O most excellent one, and shortly you shall prosper in the rule." So this is a direct quotation from one of the oracles I mentioned before. But we do not have any manuscript from the 12th century. It's just this indirect quotation that allows us to conclude that that collection was evident and present in the imperial library of the 12th century. So after this first part, I want to come to my second or more practical part of prognosis and practical examples of prognosis. Tonight's topic is resources of prognostication, and I want to continue with an illustrating episode dated to the first half of the 9th century. It combines stored knowledge and human capital at court. The use and interpretation of oracles can be found in the Synopsis of History by John Skilitzis. The story took place at the end of the reign of Leo V, 813 to 820, who reintroduced iconoclasm. The general Michael conspired against the emperor. Leo put him into jail and did not decide to kill him. However, the end of his reign was told him several times. Now the quotation from Skilitzis. "It is said that an oracle had been delivered to him some time earlier, which said that he was destined to be deprived both of the imperial dignity and also of his very life itself, on the day of the birth and incarnation of Christ our God. It was a Sibylline oracle, written in a certain book in the imperial library, which contained not only oracles, but also pictures and the features of those who had been emperors, depicted in colors. Now, there was a ferocious lion portrayed in that book. Above its spine and going down to its belly was the letter X or He. There was a man running after the beast and striking it a mortal blow with his lance right in the center of the X. On account of the obscurity of the oracle, only the then quaestor could make sense of its meaning, that an emperor named Leo was going to be delivered to a bitter death on the day of Christ's nativity. End of quotation. Several observations can be made here. The emperor tries to explore future developments. Several signs showed the end of his reign. He remembered the rich resources at court and sent an official to the imperial library. The book delivered by the expert contained the Sibylline oracles. The Sibylliki Chrismi were a compilation of oracles organized in 14 books. 8 fragments can be added. They should not be confused with the Sibylline books containing wisdom of the ancient Etruscans and Romans, which were burned by order of the general Flavius Stilicho in 405. The Sibylline oracles can be dated from the 2nd century before Christ to the 7th century after Christ. The prophecies were composed in Greek hexameters and preserved in late medieval manuscripts again. The collection was compiled from Judeo-Egypt sources mixed with Christian elements. The importance of the prophecies derives from their independent testimony of Christian faith, emphasizing monotheistic imaginations and the coming of a glorious kingdom after mankind had suffered from many catastrophes. The oracles perfectly match concepts of eschatology. The book from the Imperial Library contained prophecies for emperors, including illustrations. We have a nice illustration of that event. It is taken from the famous Cilicis Matritensis manuscript that was copied in the middle of the 12th century in Sicily, illustrating the chronicle of Cilicis. And here we see the story I just quoted. The emperor is sitting on his throne here, and he asks his official to bring the book from the library, and he asks him to interpret these images here. And I have another more detail. So, as the source says, there are images or depictions of emperors, and also some actions can be discovered here. So this is one of the rare examples that we have an image of such a process, of such an action, that the emperor consults an expert in occult sciences, and that he sends him to the imperial library where such literature is stored. And this may be one of the causes that that books are not preserved, because the imperial library was destroyed at the end of the Byzantine Empire, and it was secret wisdom or a secret book that was kept in the imperial archive. The emperor, back to Leo, relied on the expertise of a high official, but his knowledge did not save his life. The emperor went to the general in custody, who slept silently, Michael. Leon hesitated to murder him, but decided to postpone the execution. He attended the morning mass after the Holy Eve and was murdered by supporters of Michael, who were dressed up in monastic cloths. End of that story. Experts in occult sciences are recorded in all centuries, but no comprehensive history of that profession exists until so far. The first attempt has been made by Stefani Vlavianos, covering 3 centuries. Let us move to the 12th century, a heyday of astrology and other occult sciences. One of the most important sources of that period is the work of Anna Komnini, who wrote a biography of her father Alexios in the middle of the 12th century. In the so-called Alexias, some hints on prognostication can be detected. Anna mixed feelings about occult sciences, especially astrology. In the 6th book, Anna mentions the death of the Norman ruler Robert Guiscard. His end was foretold by an oracle, Chrismos, that was explained by the mathematician Seth, who was also an expert in astrology. Anakomnene writes, a certain scholar called Seth, who boasted loudly of his knowledge of astrology, had foretold Robert's death after his crossing to Illyricum. The prediction, set out by an oracle on paper and before being sealed, was handed to some of the emperor's closest friends. Seth told them to keep the document for some time. Then, when Robert died, on his instructions they opened it. The oracle ran thus: a great enemy from the west, who has caused much trouble, will die suddenly. All wondered at the skill of the man. He had indeed reached the peak of his science. End of quote. Anna provides an insight into the practical work of an expert at court. What a wonderful trick, one would say. It was common to use pieces of paper or parchment in order to get answers or to predict developments in the political culture. There's another striking example by Anna Komnene as well in her historiography. Simeon Seth, the expert mentioned here, is a well-known scholar because works of him on diet, physics, and the heavenly bodies have survived. That episode directly leads Anna's discretion on the nature of oracles and experts who interpret them. So this is the start of a discretion dealing with astrology. She argues that the oracular method was a new development and not known to ancient astrologers and astronomers. It was not mentioned by Plato, Evdoxos, and Manetho. Anna herself had knowledge in astrology, but she did not practice it, but she wanted to recognize its practitioners. During the reign of her father Alexios, the sciences flourished, but Alexios was not very keen on astrology, because he was convinced that faith in God may be stronger than faith in the stars. Anna mentions three other astrologers or experts: Theodoros Alexandrinos, Eleftherios Sebelenos, and Katanankis from Athens. The methodos Chrismon was not a recent invention in general, but a certain technique. It followed the standard tools of astrologers. Searching for texts on that method, 6 manuscripts can be found that were partly edited until so far. Anna's digression is exceptional because it demonstrates a trend towards a focus on astrology and offers a more personal statement of an author, including her ambiguous interest in occult sciences. The context of Anna's Alexias has to be taken into consideration as well. She wrote it in the first decade of Emperor Manuel I Komnenos, who was her nephew. Her nephew, Manuel, was keen on occult sciences and he supported experts of astrology and oracular practices. He was able to watch and interpret the constellations of the stars by himself. Later, he had to defend himself against accusations of astrological practices. In a statement, he mentions the comet of the year 1147, predicting the Second Crusade on the 12th of February 1147. He writes that the expert of that time correctly interpreted the sign. And Manuel uses the term technites for expert. And the technites, expert is the best translation, technites is a person who does or handles a thing by the rules of art, a skilled workman, so to say. But before discussing Manuel's abilities to calculate dates, a few words on the importance of predictions based on letters and words, especially names, should be made. The Greek script does not provide signs for numbers, with a few exceptions, but uses the letters as numerical symbols. Therefore, Greek words can hide or include numbers. It was common that experts in numerology tried to predict, for instance, the duration of a reign by analyzing the name of the emperor. The best example is Manuel, whose last two letters, eta and lambda, can be read as a number, 8 and 30, that is 38, and generations after him counted the years of his rulership and came to 38 years. So this is a clear indication for Byzantine experts that the date or the duration of a rulership can be read in an emperor's name. But there's another important or famous oracle that is preserved in the historiography of Nikitos Koniatis. It was common that at the beginning of a life horoscopes were made in Byzantium as well, and the birth of a new child is celebrated at the imperial court as well. And I quote Manuel from his Chroniki Digis. This event was in the year 1167, the birthday of Alexios II. Celebrating the child's birthday and name-giving, Manuel, as is the custom among the Roman emperors, regaled the city's residents and named his son Alexios, choosing this name neither impulsively nor in honor of the grandfather's name, but taking heed of the oracular utterance in answer to the question, how long shall the dynasty of Alexios Komnenos reign? The oracular response was Haima. If divided into letters and recounted in their order, the Alpha clearly designated Alexios, the Iota John, and the next two letters Manuel and his successor to the throne. And if you take the Comnenian dynasty or the names of the rulers into a line, it is clear that the oracle matches the first letters of the names and forms the word blood. Some words to Nikitos Koniatis. Nikitos Koniatis is an important figure in literature and also at court in the 12th century. He was a high official at various on various levels, and he served various emperors, and he eyewitnessed the Fourth Crusade. His Chroniki Digis, or historiography, provides first-hand information on imperial policy and decisions at court. The tone of his historiography is rather pessimistic and critical about the Comnenian dynasty that led the empire to the disaster of 1204. Koniatis is critical about occult sciences and their proponents. He mocks the astrologers as, quote, those who gaze at the sky while barely seeing what is at their feet on the basis of the equine configuration and frequent whirlings around, a long life for the emperor, predicting a long life for the emperor, end of quote. As mentioned before, Nikitos knew the oracular Leonis because he quoted a passage in his history. It is likely that he had access to the imperial library. He sardonically presents examples of predictions that led to, for instance, military disasters. Even the Emperor Manuel performed as astrologer. There's a longer example, but I will not bring it here. A military, Constantine Angelos, headed for Italy, and Manuel calculated the date of the start of this expedition, and he miscalculated it, and he sent Angelos the wrong time to Italy, and he did not succeed there. And Nikitos pokes fun at the efficiency of the horoscope that was cast a second time. Quote, so advantage was the determination of the exact moment to the success of Roman affairs, that forthwith Constantine Angelos was delivered into the hands of the enemy directly. So an important example for the argument here that the emperor, even the emperor, is keen on astrology, and he also knows how to calculate and to watch the stars and to make decisions by using that those techniques. The next quotation, again from Nikitos Koniatis, here again the critical statement of the historiographer, who mocks the emperor again. Manuel has the reprehensible belief that the retrograde and progressive motion of stars and their positions, as well as the configurations of the planets, their proximity and distances, influence the fortunes and circumstances of human life. And he believed in all those other things that astrologers falsely attribute to divine providence, while deceptively introducing such phrases as "it was decreed" and "the decrees of necessity are unchangeable and irreversible." In such fashion, he determined that Angelo's expedition would be propitious. So this is the quotation in extenso attached to the unsuccessful expedition of Angelos. The next example offers another technique of prognostication. The follower of Manuel I was Alexios, but Alexios was eliminated by Andronikos I, who ruled 2 years until 1185, and he was also keen, or he was also interested in questions that were important for emperors. He wanted to know how long he will rule, and to get this information, he employed an expert. And just want to quote a short passage from this longer quotation. He asks an expert who is dealing with lekanomantia. Lekanomantia is prognosis by reading water. You look into a pot of water and you discover certain words or letters. Andronikos became fascinated by the competence of the expert, and he asks the expert a lot of questions. Said, the expert he is mentioned here, reads letters in the water bowl, but the problem is that the client, Andronikos Komnenos, misinterprets that letters, and at the end he wants to know who will follow him, and the expert can read two letters, iota and a sigma, and he thinks that a certain Isakios will follow him on the throne. But he misinterpreted the name, and he thought that it is a usurper far away from Constantinople, and he did not search in Constantinople itself for a possible usurper. End of the story is that he trusted in the techniques of this expert, but he made a false interpretation, and therefore his rule came to an end, as you can read here in extenso. There's one, or lekanomantia is one of the normal practices at the imperial court to make a prognosis. And again, there's a nice depiction in the Scilicis Martidensis illustrating an expert telling the future during the reign of Theophilos in the 9th century. And here you see the elements. The expert is reading something in this pot here and combining it with pointing to a star here and telling the emperor here the future or the next ruler or whatsoever. In the last 45 minutes, I tried to show the importance of prognosis and techniques of prognostication. Calculation, counting numbers are very important in Byzantine expertism or whatever, and experts are always keen on numerology and the exact sciences. So counting, measuring, weighing is very important. Astrology and astronomy are part of this kind of sciences, and in the short presentation I could only offer a small segment of all relevant sources. We should include also, for instance, dream books, and dream books always refer to the society and the context of the society and also to techniques of fortune telling. The Byzantine emperor was instead in need of advice and explanation of phenomena that may cause disturbance or insecurity. Signs and phenomena could quickly lead to a bad press and Kaiser critique, a verdict that was intensively discussed in late antiquity and in the Middle Byzantine period. However, experts in occult sciences did not disappear in Byzantium, and they belonged to the human capital at court. Dozens of persons are recorded that supported the imperial court in decision-making. Experts, technite, were also necessary to interpret or discuss knowledge that was stored in the imperial library. I showed the examples of the Sibylline oracles and the Oracula Leonis. Exceptional examples are emperors who performed certain kinds of occult sciences by themselves. Examples Manuel I Komnenos or Leon, for instance. I wanted to demonstrate that prognosis influenced imperial decision-making and underline once more that the practical aspect of prognostication has to be kept in mind all the time. It allowed externalization of decision-making or opinion-making and offered double indemnity. The emperor cannot be blamed for wrong decisions. Thank you very much.